For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so we're going to look at two genealogies in the book of Genesis. And just if you're joining us for the first time, obviously this is the first book of the Bible. And the thing about this book that's really special is it's a book of origins. It's kind of like, I don't know, I like to creek. When I was a kid, I used to go into creeks and just go crashing through, exploring and stuff. And where my grandfather lived, they had a lot of creeks that were spring-fed. Toward the beginning of the creek, you could kind of go up and explore the headwaters of some of them, because they're almost like bubbling out of the ground. And that's really what we're doing with the book of Genesis. We're way upstream in the headwaters, studying the source of things, like where we came from, how we're built, you know, what our makeup is, you know, the world that we live in, who put us here. That's the focus. But now as the book's unfolding, we're coming down a little bit further into the stream. We're starting to see how some of these core themes that we're looking at, boy, some of these basic elements still affect our lives today. We're way downstream from the book of Genesis, but a lot of the things it teaches us about human nature and the way we operate, they're all there. That's why it's so relevant still, is because it touches on fundamental themes that affect our lives and the way we're built. Okay, so these genealogies, there's two of them. One's in Genesis 4, 17 through 24. The other one is in chapter 5. And I realize there's a little trepidation here about this kind of thing. You think about, there's probably a temptation you hear. We're going to get into something like he begat, he begat, he begat, he begat. It can be a little mind-numbing. You read, like in this passage, became the father of. It's enough to lull you to sleep. It's a real structured pattern to these genealogies. People that purpose to read the whole Bible, this is the graveyard where they die. You're like, so you tried to read the Bible. That's great. How far did you get? Genesis 5. And that's when the wheels came off. Definitely better than melatonin. You want to fall asleep, I recommend what we're about to study. it won't be that bad. And for good reason, these passages are rarely taught. We're going to throw caution to the wind this morning and just double down and not just do two genealogies. We're even going to bring in a third one. So, yeah, we'll see if anyone's still awake by the time this is over. All right. The genealogies that we're going to focus on, they represent two really different branches of humanity. Different people, different values, different outlook, different in every way. And just to kind of get you back up to speed on where these branches of humanity came from. Remember, the serpent, Satan, came into the garden and he enticed Adam and Eve to sin. And so they disobeyed God. After they disobeyed God, God came to them and predicted, actually he told Satan, that there would be enmity or hostility between Eve's seed and the serpent's seed. And he was referring to people that are under God's influence and people that, like Satan, have rebelled against God. He said there's going to be a fracture in humanity between people that are aligned with God and people that aren't. It goes on and it talks about a very pointed example of this enmity, where he murders his own brother Abel in cold blood. And then we see, and we're going to see it today, this fracture goes beyond Cain and Abel, beyond the family, just the small nuclear family, and explodes across all of humanity. So that's what we're going to study, is the ripple effect of this initial decision to rebel against God and how it splits humanity in two. Now, The other thing about these genealogies is there's two key players in both of them. One is Cain, who we talked about last week. Cain's a murderer. He had a son named Enoch, and then Irad, Methushael, and Lamech. Then the other genealogy, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, all these names, all the way down to Noah, who was alive during the great flood. And as we look at these, you'll see very clearly, these are very different groups of people with different values. And then beyond all that, next week, we're going to spend the whole time talking about the great flood, Noah's flood, which has a whole separate set of issues connected to it. But that flood stands like a shadow over all of this. And eventually what will happen is the entire line of people descended from Cain are going to be completely obliterated. They're going to get wiped out. And even from Seth's line, only a few will survive the flood. So the trajectory these two groups of people are on is very different. Here's another thing with these genealogies. Is there a big problem for people today? People, you know, with a scientific background, people with a college education, people read these genealogies and they really get tripped up. Here's one example of why. If you calculate the average lifespan of people in Seth's genealogy, it's 910 years. People living 910 years old. Like around here in Columbus, some of the oldest trees we have, this is a white oak. It makes it to about 600 years. Most of them die younger than that. So the 910 years, that's how long these people lived. Some even more than that. You know, hobbits. Hobbits only live to 100 years. The only way you can live longer than that is if you have the Ring of Power, right? You know, if you wear that ring like Smeagol did, you can live a really long time. But you just think about what this is saying. People living for like 9 centuries. It's hard for people to accept. So what do we do with this? Maybe the years are months. That's one solution people have proposed. The problem with that is if the years are months, then Enoch became the father of Methuselah when he was a 5-year-old. That requires a miracle of a different sort. That doesn't seem likely. The other possibility is some people have connected these lifespans to different astrological charts in the area. I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support that. What about the fact that they're just literally living that long? I think that's the best view, and I'll tell you why. After the flood, if you look at the genealogy of Noah's sons and Shem's descendants and so on, you'll see that the lifespans of people gradually decline. They go from about 600 all the way down to about 200. And then by the time of Moses and Joshua, lifespans have come all the way down to your standard 120 years or less. So the idea that, you know, we take these lifespans literally in the rest of the Bible, there's no reason to back up and say these are figurative. The best take on this is that they really did live that long. Now, why would they point out this decline in lifespans? It may be that in the early part of humanity, it's possible that conditions on earth, there's something about the way our environment was that allowed us to live longer. It's also, just God's involved. If God's involved in this whole equation, they could have lived 100,000 years, right? If God's involved, Jonah can swallow the whale. Doesn't just have to, we just don't have to believe that a whale could swallow Jonah. The fact that we believe in an all-powerful God that can do miracles, if you accept that premise, then this isn't a big deal. I honestly think what you're seeing with the stable lifespans before the flood and then the declining lifespan of people afterwards is the progressive degenerative effect of sin. I think that's what we're seeing in these passages. But anyhow, yeah, I think we should take these. These guys were old. Here's another problem. If you do the math, if you add up the time between each of these generations, and then you go into chapter 11 and you pick up with Noah's son Shem and keep adding ages of generations. Some people have done this to calculate the year that Adam was born. You know, Abraham, he was born around 2166 BC. And if you back it up by adding up all these generations, some people calculate that Adam was born about 4004 BC. Some people push it a little bit later, like 4100 BC. And that is also a problem because almost all anthropologists would argue that modern humans like us are much, much older. We have settlements and remains of people that go way, way back before 4004 BC. And so this second problem I'm going to kind of set aside. We'll come back to it when it's appropriate. But yeah, this is why some folks have a hard time with these. But hopefully by the time we're done, you'll be satisfied the Bible has a good answer. All right, now let's talk about Cain's line. It says, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Remember, Cain was upset because he was banished to wander. He blamed his problems on God. He never turned back to God. He just struck out in rebellion against God. Kind of an iconic picture of all of humanity. That's really what his line is. It's an archetype of rebellious humanity. Well, it goes on and it says, Cain had relations with his wife and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. Now here, what's the classic question? Where'd he get his wife from, right? A lot of people ask this. I honestly don't see what the big deal is. It said he was a farmer, right? A tiller of the ground. So it's obvious he got his wife from farmersonly.com. That's got to be it. I don't know why people get hung up on this. No. All right, that's a pretty bad joke. I'll move on. We know from Genesis 5, it says that Adam and Eve had lots of sons and daughters. And so what happened was he married his sister. That's what happened. I know that's kind of a stunning thing, but that's who was available. And that raises the question, that kind of sounds like incest. You know, the idea of like having a baby with your sister. There's that, no doubt. But you've got to remember, it was God's will for humanity to descend from one couple, from one man, from one woman. And there weren't a lot of options. And early on, there were a lot of babies being born, lots of brothers and sisters being born. God told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. They were in perfect physical health. So there were tons of kids being born, and Cain chose one of them to be his wife. Later in the Bible condemns incest, which it should, but early on, this was the only way forward, so that's where his wife came from. Now, pressing on, it says, Cain built a city, and he called the name of the city Enoch, after the name of his son. Now, to Enoch was born Irad, and Irad became the father of Mahujael. Mahujael became the father of Methushael, and Methushael became the father of Lamech. It goes on, Lamech took to himself two wives. The name of the one was Ada, the name of the other Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. And as for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain. So it was Jabal, Jubal, and Tubal-Cain were the kids. That's kind of a cool. Those are cool names. I don't know. Let's see. The forger of all implements of bronze and iron. So he was a metal worker. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives Ada and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech. For I've killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, than Lamech 77-fold. Okay. Now, right off, when we read this, it's not all bad. There's some okay things in here. There's stuff like animal husbandry, you know, raising livestock, you know, creating music, you know, working with metal, metallurgy. You know, some people have, over the years, have said these things, these areas of human technology and creativity are by definition wrong because they're part of the line of Cain. That's absolutely nuts. What you're seeing here, this, the intellectual achievements, the technological advancements, the artistic creativity, that's possible because we're image bearers. We're made in the image of God. This is part of what it means to be a human being. These are the things that distinguish us from the rest of what God has made. They're evidence that we bear God's image. I got a buddy who's an engineer. He works at Honda, and he tests the tensile strength of metal to see how it'll handle a crash and that kind of thing. I wouldn't go to him and say that's the devil's work you're into or something like that. It's preposterous. And this is, you know, any attempt to take something like this and argue for an anti-intellectual posture, to argue against Christians playing a meaningful role in some of these areas, that's preposterous. Actually, if you look at history, some of the earliest scientists were Christians. And they were Christians, and they were led to science because we believe in an orderly God who made a world that can be understood. So these are things that we should be involved in, just like the rest of our culture. So yeah, it's not all bad. We got to be careful to not misread this. On the other hand, there are clear signs of rebellion. I don't know if you caught this, but there's no mention of God anywhere here. I think that's conspicuously absent. You'll especially see that as we look at Seth's line. There's nothing about God here. This is a God-type culture. This is people making advancements, making a name for themselves, carving out a space for themselves apart from God, away from God, struck out in a different direction from God. That is conspicuously absent here. There's nothing about any interest these people had in God. The other thing that we see is that Cain built a city. Now think about what God told him after he murdered Abel. He said, "You're going to be a wanderer, a nomad for the rest of your life." And so what does Cain do? He says, "I'm going to build a human settlement in a spot, and I'm going to name my son after it." Or I'm going to name it after my son, I guess. That's brazen defiance. Okay, that kind of sets the tone for everything that we read in this chapter. Just, you know, Cain doing this, that's totally organized humanity defying God. And again, like I talked about, this idea of headwaters. In Genesis, we see a lot of themes beginning, and this is a big theme. You know, human creativity, human government, human arts, human education, human culture, independent and opposed to God. We see it spill out when people come together to build the Tower of Babel, to make a name for themselves, to elevate themselves above God. We see it when Nebuchadnezzar has the great kingdom of Babylon and he surveys it. And he's like, "Look at this great kingdom that I've created." We see it again and again. We see it today. When this culture builds, human enterprise to exalt self and does not acknowledge God, that same heart of rebellion, which is woven into every part of the culture we're in, is very alive and well today. So this is just the beginning. And it all starts with that city. Of course, Lamech is pretty bad. He's a polygamist, right? He took two wives. The Bible's ideal in the very beginning is monogamy, a man and a wife, two people together. He takes two wives. This is the first time this happens in the Bible. He's also a murderer, and he threatens his own wives. You remember the song that Adam sung to Eve? It was like a beautiful poem. He was like, "You're bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. I don't know if you've sung that to your spouse anytime recently. My wife would be like, what are you doing? But yeah, that kind of heartfelt expression of love. But what do we get from Lamech? Listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. I'm not going to sing this. I don't know what tune it was set to, but give heed to my speech. I've killed a man just for wounding me and a boy for striking me. What's he trying to say? You cut me, I kill you, right? You touch me, I kill you. You cross me, you're dead. What is this? If you're Ada and Zillah, what's your take home? It's like, I better do what he says or I'm going to die. He sees, like, if Cain's avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. This is a raw assertion of power. This is somebody who's like, I will have things my way. This is the heart of a tyrant. And again, this is a theme we see over, like, with Pharaoh, with Nebuchadnezzar, with the kings of Persia, with the Romans, with all the way through history. In every single human government and culture, we see the spirit of tyranny, of self-assertion, of taking for self, of doing violence to get what we want. That's what we're reading about here. And again, it's just woven right into the thread of this line of people. And so we've got a really weird paradox here. And we've talked about this a couple times already. We've got this weird tension between, we've got humans in the image of God doing stunning things with the brain that God gave them and the hands that God gave them. And yet we also have human culture stained by sin, deeply stained by sin. And the Bible is relentless in affirming both of these truths about humanity. This is a couple, Jay Austin and Lauren Gugagan, yeah, sorry. They're cyclists, or I should say they were cyclists. They decided to travel around the world and write a blog about their experiences. So they were pedaling through Europe, through Africa, through Asia, all over the place. And you can actually go to their blog. It's still up from their travels. And this is them writing. It says, you watch the news, you read about the papers, and you're led to believe that the world's a big, scary place. People, the narrative goes, are not to be trusted. So they're kind of pushing back to that. They would push back to the second bullet, that we're stained by sin, that there's something really broken. They go on, they're like, people are bad, they're evil. There are axe murderers and monsters and worse. I don't buy it. It's interesting. They're like, yeah, this is the party line. And they're like, you know what? I don't buy this in the heart. I don't. They're like, we're traveling around. We don't see this. Evil's a make-believe concept we've invented to deal with the complexities of fellow humans holding values and beliefs and perspectives different than our own. They go on, it's easier to dismiss opinion as abhorrent than to strive to understand it. Badness exists, but even that's quite rare. They go on and say, by and large, humans are kind, self-interested, sometimes myopic, sometimes, but kind. And so they described how they would go to places and they'd park their bikes and people would bring food out to them. Another time they were in a country, a war-torn country, and a group of singers came up and did an impromptu performance. They were welcomed into homes. They had people just completely, well, you know, just care for them along the way. And they're writing about this and saying, this is our take home from our travels. No greater revelation has come from our journey than this. Well, that was in April of 2018. 3 months later, they were in Tajikistan. And an extremist group surrounded them with SUVs. Them and two other riders from Europe stabbed him to death and drove over their dead bodies. So, yeah, that's a brutal outcome. But and it's hard to hear this, such a hopeful story. But this is the test of a good worldview, right? Our worldview ought to cohere with what's out there. And the biblical worldview does. The biblical worldview tells us that we're killer angels, that we are amazing, but capable of great evil. And that was a hard way to learn it. You know, and it says in Hebrews 11:10, Abraham, one of the descendants of Shem and Noah, he was confidently looking forward to a city with eternal foundations, a city designed and built by God. And, you know, we get really hung up about our government. We have like huge talks about politics and whatnot. But the men of God, the men that were following God, this is the city that they were looking for. Our cities are they're built on broken foundations. And because of that, there'll always be a mixture of brilliance and injustice. It's going to always be that way. If you're looking for a perfect city, it's coming. But it's a city founded on God, not on us. So anyhow, that's Cain's line. Now, let's think about Seth's line. Nothing really great as far as achievements go. That doesn't mean no achievements happened. It just isn't the author's focus. He focuses instead on people who follow God. And there are some very notable examples of people that were really passionate about following God in this line. The other thing you'll notice is if you look at these two genealogies, you've got Cain and Seth again. They're very carefully constructed. In this passage, he's going to compare Cain and Seth, Enoch and Enosh, and then Lamech and Enoch. The first, second, and sixth generations from Adam are what the author zooms in on to help us appreciate just how different Seth's line is. So let's go through Cain and Seth. Obviously, we know about Cain. Cain went out, built a city in defiance against God. It says, Adam had relations with his wife, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. Okay, this is after Abel dies. Eve is like, I want my son back. She has a new son, Seth. And she says, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. The word Seth means the appointed one. And she saw him that way. She saw him as somebody that God appointed for this role. And he saw himself that way too. It's clear as you trace his lineage that the people he was connected to were pursuing God. You definitely see that with his son Enosh, who's on the right there. If you read the next verse, it says, to Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And it says at that time, right around the time when Seth was born. So this is a big influence right around the time Enosh was born, people began calling upon the name of God. So people are turning toward God for direction and guidance under the influence of Seth, because it's happening right when his son is born. But it seems like in an ongoing way with Enosh as well. Very unlike Enoch, who had a city that wasn't supposed to be built named after him. This is with Enosh, we see people calling on the name of the Lord. Further down, obviously Lamech, bad, but what about Enoch? And this is, again, Enoch on the right in Seth's line. It says, Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God for 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And that is a very strong statement about Enoch in Seth's line. It says that he walked with God. That concept, there's another theme. It started in the garden. This is the same word used in Genesis to describe how Adam would walk with God in the cool of the garden. That it's a picture of intimacy, you know, being close to somebody, being near to someone. This is something that Enoch enjoyed. It's describes trajectory, about going in the same direction that God's going in, walking with him step by step. And it also describes a mentality where we're agreeing with God about our life, about what's true, about what matters. There's another theme here. God's people walk with him in a relationship with him. And we see that modeled by Enoch, 300 years of this. The other thing we see is, and this is one of two people in the Old Testament that just get vaporized. Elijah was the same way. One day Enoch was taking a long walk with God and he never came back because God took him. He beamed him up and that was it. No more Enoch. People are like, what happened? I don't know. He's gone. And God took him because he delighted in him. And so again, think about the contrast. What did we see with Lamech? Murder, threats, death. And what we see with Enoch is life, eternal life, going to be with God. I hope you can appreciate, I could geek out on this more. These are very carefully structured genealogies, right? Really carefully designed to help you see the difference between Seth's line and Cain's line. Okay, now, what's the point of all this? Well, there's a lot going on here. Here's one thing that's really cool about this. What we're reading, and the point of all these genealogies is to trace the lineage, to trace the ancestors of the seed. In the Bible, there's this very important person called the seed, who eventually we find out is Jesus Christ. But what we learn at the beginning is that he's a male descendant of Eve that's going to be born. And that he's going to come and crush Satan. He'll totally defeat Satan. All the way through, if you read the early chapters of Genesis really carefully, you can tell people are wondering, is this the seed? Is this the seed? Is this the guy? You know, was the seed Cain? No. Disqualified. You can't murder people and be the seed. So it wasn't him. Is the seed Seth? Well, Seth was godly, but Seth came and went. No, the seed wasn't Seth. What about the seed being Noah? Interesting. If you read Eve's reaction to Seth being born, she's like, he's the appointed one. She thought maybe this is the guy. He wasn't. When Noah was born, similar language. This is his father Lamech saying he called his son Noah, saying this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. All right, so they looked at these kids being born and they'd look them in the eyes and go, are you the seed? Are you the one that was promised to be born to Eve? And they weren't. None of them were. But what we're finding out isn't who the seed is yet, but where he comes from, what his lineage is. Look at these genealogies. Anything strike you about these? Look at the parallel length in chapter 5 and chapter 11. Look at how they all three end with three names. Interesting. This is definitely carefully structured. Is the seed going to come from the line of Cain, the person who defeats Satan? No. They're going to get obliterated by the flood. The seed's going to come from Seth. And all the way down, Enosh, Canaan, and so on. Now, is the seed going to come from Shem, Ham, Japheth? Not from Ham and Japheth. It'll be a descendant of Shem. That's what the passage teaches. That's what this genealogy teaches. And then Shem, it'll be Arpachshad, Shelah. The seed will come from that line. Then we get Abraham, Nahor, Haran. Which one? Not Nahor and Haran. This descendant is going to be through Abraham. That's why when we get to Genesis 12, God tells Abraham, in you, Abraham, in your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Okay, so that's what this is all about. It's about the author, Moses, trying to help us readers figure out who's going to give rise to the seed, to the Messiah, eventually to Jesus Christ. And if you study in the New Testament, you look at Jesus' lineage, it has these names. Because these are the people that he was descended from. All right. Yeah, so you got Abraham. And then, aware of this, let's think back at that question. Can I use genealogies to start calculating the age of humanity? Can I just add up the numbers of years between the generations Is that what the author is trying to communicate? How old people are? That's not his focus. His focus is on what I just showed you, helping you identify who the seed is. He's tracing the lineage of the seed. And so any approach to this text where we're getting our spreadsheet out and trying to add up how old Adam was or how far back ago he was born, it's a wrong-headed approach. I say that for a couple additional reasons. One is, and I don't have time to show a bunch of examples, but biblical genealogies are incomplete. They skip generations. You study them, there's many, many generations left out of biblical genealogies. And the reason why is the word yilad, which means become the father of, can also mean become the ancestor of. Go look at just a scholarly dictionary, look up that word. It doesn't just mean I'm the immediate father of this person. It can mean I'm the forefather. I became the ancestor of that person. And so it's really important that, we don't bend this into some kind of absurd calculation of when Adam was born. Because we do things like that, and then the Bible gets run into the ground. And we're associating the Bible with claims that it's never made. We can't operate that way. These are two scholars from Princeton right around the turn of the last century. And I agree with what they say here. This is William Green. He says, the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11 were not intended to be used and can't properly be used for the construction of a chronology. And then you've got B.B. Warfield. It's to biblical theology a matter of complete indifference how long humans have existed on the earth. I think that's right. We got to be really careful about what we're trying to make these genealogies do. We should let them do what the author is trying to do. All right, here's another obvious implication. Humanity was and still is heading off into two completely different trajectories. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we talked about this. Francis Schaeffer, in his excellent commentary on Genesis, he says, from this time on in the flow of biblical history, there are two humanities from the time of Cain and Seth. The one humanity says there's no God, or makes its own gods in its own imagination, or it tries to come to God in its own way. The other humanity comes to the true God in God's way. And there's no neutral ground. That's right. We have to decide, am I going to align with God and align with his people and come to him on his terms and submit to his rule and walk with him, or am I going to strike out like Cain in defiance of God and do my own thing? That'll be, again, a huge theme. And the dividing line between those two groups will always be faith. It will always be, am I willing to put my trust in Christ? Am I willing to depend on God to give me the covering for my sin that I need to make me presentable before him? So that's the crucial question. Will you approach God on his terms? That's really what determines which branch of humanity we join. This is something, too. I realize we're looking at genealogies and people are born into this and born into that. That's not how your relationship with God works. You're not born into being a Christian because you grew up in a Christian home. You're not born into your faith because you were born into a certain culture. We have to freely choose this. This is something that when you read invitations to come to know God, this is what's emphasized. You know, as the Bible unfolds, the person ultimately we need to depend on is Jesus. And when Jesus makes his appeal to us, it's an appeal to put your trust in him. Not to be a good person, but to lean on him to make you presentable. Just look at this, the language. He says, to all who believed him and accepted him, you know, that freely chose to approach him, he gave the right to become children of God. They're reborn, not with a physical birth resulting from human passion or plan, but a birth that comes from God. If you want God's life, the life that Enoch found when he was beamed up, you can have it, but you have to go to Christ for it. That's how we become part of his humanity. All right, one last thought here. If you do know Christ, the Bible says you are part of a new humanity. That's why you get this language. You know, anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new creature. The old life is gone. The new life has come. So if you know Christ, this is you. You are part of this new humanity. But that doesn't mean we have to live that way. A lot of believers, a lot of Christians are out there, and what fuels and energizes their life is the same broken value system, the same God-tight perspective on life that drove Cain and his line. And so think about, I don't know what you would fill in, when you think about the way of Cain, you think about using musical talents to exalt yourself, making a pile of cash to serve yourself, pursuing some athletic achievement so that you can exalt yourself. Whatever it is, if it doesn't involve God, if it isn't under God's leadership, that's the way of Cain. If those kinds of things are dominating our life, even though we're part of God's family, we're definitely not. We're living like we're part of Cain's family. Think about the striking difference here. After everything that we've said, in the culture of the people that follow Christ. Compare this to Lamech's song. It says, Jesus called them together, his disciples, and he said, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people. Officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it'll be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and give his life as a ransom for many. That doesn't sound like Lamech. And that doesn't have the vibe of the Tower of Babel or Nebuchadnezzar surveying his kingdom and pounding his chest with pride. This is the guy that knelt on his feet and washed our feet. This is the guy that went to the cross and surrendered his life, who set aside his priorities so he could attend to our needs. That's the way of Seth. That's the way of this other humanity. And I know for me, that has had everything to do with why I'm sitting here. When I was little, I had a next door neighbor, actually my grandfather's next door neighbor, a deeply committed Christian, and I watched him unprovoked serve my grandfather in many different practical ways. I had dinner over at his house. I had long conversations. He was one of the only adults I knew that really listened to me. That, you know, I felt like this guy actually sees me, he cares about me. And when he invited me to go to church with him, that was a no-brainer. Because I'd never met somebody that operated like him. You know, I went to that church and I did become a Christian, but I didn't see this guy very often. I fell away from God. I came back, I think it was 6 years later, I came out to this church as a 17-year-old. And I was at a retreat at a place called Woodland Alders. And I was sitting under a staircase, and at this time I was skeptical, aversive to Christianity, but I was under this staircase with a bunch of high school students. And if you've ever seen the movie The Breakfast Club, it was kind of an environment like that, where you've got the jocks, the preps, the honor society people, the pot smokers, you got everybody. And there was a depth of love and concern, a willingness to defer and listen. There was the palpable presence of a different value system, love. And it was too compelling to walk away from. I had to learn more about it. That's why it's not a heaven and hell thing. If you're a Christian, you'll always be a Christian. But this is an aroma of Christ thing. If as a community of people, we decisively reject the violent, threatening, taking, self-serving ethos of a world apart from God, and we decide we're going to live a different way, like Jesus is laying out, it'll be powerful. And people will come, and they will keep coming, because they're not going to find that anywhere else. So Yeah, that's crucial. I guess it's important just to ask yourself, am I embracing these values of this new humanity and living it out? So, okay. Father, we just we know that we're prone to wander. Like it says in Isaiah 53, all of us like sheep, we go astray. Help us heighten our confidence that throwing in with you is the way to go. That's really what this is all about. Help us just see you as the path to follow, God.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.